Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
And welcome to New Horror Express, your weekly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's episode, I'm talking to director Cody Callahan about his film, The Oak Room. Over the course of the interview, I talked to Cody about why he wanted to make a movie adaptation of the play, The Oak Room, how he wanted to avoid making the film look stagey despite its limited locations, and how he accomplished the effect of making this winter-set Canadian tale feel almost viscerally cold for the viewer. You can practically feel the snow coming off the screen. Also, you will hear Cody and I talk about 90s independent cinema, the similarities between small-town Scotland and small-town Canada, and a little bit about his latest film, the horror comedy Vicious Fun, all of which and much, much more you can hear right now in our interview with Cody. Hi, Cody. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Thanks for having me.
It's good to have you on the show. Today, we've got you on the show to talk about your film, The Oak Room. So for the audience, can you give us a brief synopsis, a brief spoiler-free synopsis of The Oak Room?
I can try. I still have trouble pitching this movie in a short sentence, but it's basically about a drifter who returns to his hometown to settle a debt with an old friend, and things get out of control pretty fast, and it gets a little violent.
It's a nice taster of the film. So the Oak Room was a stage play. What inspired you to adapt this for our film?
So Ari Millen, who plays Michael in the film, also played Michael in the play back in 2013. And after the play ended, Ari was always sort of infatuated with the stage play script. And I think a couple of years after that, he ran into the writer and asked him if he would be interested in adapting it into a film. And the writer said that he had thought about that quite a bit. So Ari got a hold of the play again and sent it to me. And of course, reading the tagline of the email of adapting a stage play at that point in time seemed quite daunting, but also something that I was pretty busy at the time. So I kind of shrugged it off, to be honest, at first. And then Ari kept bugging me. And eventually, I think I was on a flight to LA, and so I had some time and I sat down and read it. And I think as soon as I landed, as soon as I could, I called Ari and was in right away. So that's sort of the origin of how we got there.
You mentioned there that you felt it was quite daunting. I noticed from your previous filmography, your first three films are kind of sci-fi horrors. Was this quite a conscious attempt to try out a kind of different mode of filmmaking?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I kind of feel like when you start making movies, you're sort of every movie is like film school. So you're still trying to find your voice and find what you like to do and stuff like that. And sort of, I got sort of caught a bit in a, and I don't mean caught in a negative way, but caught in a certain type of film and a certain type of genre. And it seemed to be working. So when I read The Oak Room, it felt like a chance to sort of, to branch out. And it's like Black Fawn Films, the company that I own with Chad Archibald, we haven't done anything like this either. So it sort of, was exciting to do something different and sort of, you know, use different strengths than some of the other things that I've, you know, relied on.
I was also going to ask, obviously, you know, Ari brought the script to you and obviously he was going to be in the film. The movie is dialogue heavy, it's character driven. How long was the kind of audition process for the film? Because obviously you would need just the right actors for the parts.
So interestingly enough, obviously Ari wanted to play Michael again. And, you know, we sat down with Chad and Breakthrough Entertainment and all sort of discussed who we thought would be good for each role. And honestly, everybody was our first pick. So we didn't actually hold any auditions. We just went to some actors that we knew would be great for the role. And then, of course, I met with them and we discussed the part before giving it to them. But but yeah, there wasn't like an open audition where we saw, you know, 50 tapes for each character. We had a sort of a first and a second choice, and all our first choices loved the script and were in. So that was probably the easiest casting of any movie I've done.
Very good, very good. Obviously, there's a lot of dialogue there. It's a dense with dialogue. How much kind of preparation time was there with you and the actors before going into shoot?
So, obviously Ari and I had time to discuss the character, and he played it, played the same character in the play. So there's obviously different things he wanted to do. And, you know, he went through changes since the play, and he wanted to sort of bring some new ideas to the character. But as far as everybody else, I had a few Skype calls with RJ Mitty, who plays Steve. And as far as everybody else, it was one or two meetings where we sat down, and it was funny. We didn't discuss too much of the actual script itself, but a lot of the backstory and sort of what happens when the movie cuts, what happens after that, what happens to the character after the last scene that they're in. So I spent a lot of time with the actors just sort of discussing their characters and backstories and maybe what happened to them prior and what happened to them after. And we didn't spend too much time on the script. And that was really only the time that I got with them, is a few meetings. There was no actual rehearsals before we shot. So we kind of dived into it and we sort of rehearsed on set right before shooting. So there was not really much prep time, but I think I had a pretty good idea for each character of where I wanted to go for most scenes. And the actors themselves brought a lot of ideas to the table. So the collaboration was amazing. And I think all of those factors together sort of made it all work. But like most sort of indie low budget movies, there's not much prep time, and most of the money you see goes on the screen. So hats off to the cast, because they carried a lot of the weight.
Yeah, having talked to quite a few indie filmmakers now, I'm very aware of that now, of the lack of prep time for anything, and the quick turnovers and the short shoot times.
Yeah. Yeah, that's sort of it's funny, because you'd think that, well, we don't have much money, so there's got to be a workaround for more time. But yeah, time is money, so money is time. So yeah. Most of these kind of productions are, you rehearse and you get the actors as much as you can for your budget, but also too, is you don't want to spend too much money in prep or you end up not being able to make the movie.
So talking about the shoot of the film, I read another interview with you, and I'm very curious about what you said about the shoot of the film, the way you said you almost shot it like an anthology picture, because it's about these stories within stories, and you kind of shot each thing kind of individually. Can you talk a little bit about that?
So I mean, obviously each little break in story, whether we're in the Oak Room or the Spruce Tavern, the two bar set, they're all sort of these little anthology little stories. I mean, they're all connected and they're all sort of one through line, but they get broken up. So which was amazing is I got to shoot everything in chronological order. I mean, to a certain degree, we had to shoot everything, all the exteriors in the winter first, because by the time we had finished casting and financing, the winter was almost done. So we sort of had to rush to get sort of the pig story and the hitchhiking story in the can. And then when it came to the bars, we got to shoot everything in order, which is amazing. And I sort of approached, and it's not that it really changed a lot or dictated a lot of my decisions of what characters would say or do, but I tried to keep in mind that each of these segments was kind of like a short film where they all had to have sort of a beginning and a middle and end in order to sort of sit on their own. So I always tried to just think of each section as its own standalone piece to make sure, like, if it could stand on its own, but also be connected to all the other ones, then the movie should work in theory. And, you know, after reading some reviews and stuff like that, I think it worked, obviously, that approach.
They're talking about the individual stories, how in terms of the story structure, the audience is constantly aware that they're only being told half the story. So how difficult was it in terms of striking the balance of withholding the film's mysteries, but kind of seeding enough the audience interest doesn't tail off?
Yeah. I mean, that's sort of that's one of those things that you kind of keep finessing on the day. But we spent a lot of time playing with how much was in the script, how much was referred to, and how much we would, you know, we actually took out. So Peter Genoway, obviously, the writer was adapting his own stage play. So he's been with it for a while. So obviously it changed a bit, but a lot of the nuances and little clues and hints and props and some of the imagery, we kept putting, you know, we'd put more in, and then, you know, we'd let it sit for a couple of weeks and we'd read it again. And we'd really, in the script stage, we finessed how much we would want to see, you know, little bits of dialogue that would, you know, steer the audience certain ways. So, I mean, it's like shooting the dialogue. It's such a dance between the actors. Well, it's like on behind the camera, it was such a dance on, do we show the keys? And when we show the keys again, are they the same keys? And when we show the watch, is it the same watch? Is that story made up? Is that story true? And it was a lot of playing with prop, playing with how long you show something and putting stuff in the background. Because I think out of any movie I've done, this movie's got a ton of Easter eggs.
Yeah, it'd be an interesting film to kind of, I saw the film at Grimfest, and yeah, it'd be an interesting film to rewatch to see if I can pick up any more clues on the way, you know, knowing the ending now.
For sure.
I was also wondering, as a filmmaker, how challenging was it, or how conscious were you of the film not feeling stagey? Because a lot of films that are based on, that are stage adaptations, can have a stilted, stagey feel.
It was a tricky thing because, you know, I really didn't want the film to get too flashy and take away from the dialogue, because, I mean, it's not as absurd and crazy and I say absurd in a good way as maybe some monologues that Quentin Tarantino does or something like that. But it does have its own sort of vibe. Like the dialogue in this movie, if you stuck it in another film, it might not fit. So I knew that I didn't want to, the cameras would really have to react to the actors, and I didn't want it to get too crazy or too flashy or, you know, cut too much, because it was really, it needed to be all about the storytellers. Cause I mean, that's what the movie's really about. At its heart, it's a father and son story, but when it comes down to it, it's about storytellers and they almost, it's almost a competition of storytellers throughout the film. And again, I had to just hope that an audience would sort of agree with the decisions I was making. Cause, you know, there was obviously decisions I could have made to be far safer. And I think we just sort of relied on the fact that it's like, I loved the script and it was really good. We got the actors that we wanted. So, I mean, all of the elements are there. And so we just sort of, you know, put our heads down and muscled our way through it. And then there was definitely times on set where, you know, we'd shoot a scene and there was concerns with, like, okay, that was really slow and we didn't move the camera much, but you'd just nail a performance. And I would just rely on the fact that it's like, you know, those are the most important things when for a movie like this, is your script and your actors. So there's nothing specifically that I did to, you know, ensure that it would move along, because, you know, I feel like that was kind of already done in the script and it was just my job to just finesse that.
It's interesting that you mentioned Tarantino there. I feel like a lot of the dialogue is, it's not necessarily Tarantino-esque, but it lives somewhere between Mamet and Tarantino. Yeah. And it, So the film, because of that, the film itself feels like it has something of a 90s, a kind of throwback 90s vibe to it. Was that a conscious effort on your part, or is that just something I'm seeing?
It's funny because I think with a movie like this, you're right, it feels like it fits within that era of filmmaking. And I think right off the bat, when Jeff Mahar, who is the DP, read it, we were trying to figure out a way to actually shoot this on film, to even give it that sort of like, what, you know, timeless sort of, what era is this actually from? Because in the movie, you know, there's old cars, but there's new phones, and it sort of just sort of sits in this generic time and place where you can't really put your finger on a year. So it's not that it was conscious to pick like the movies of the 90s, but we were inspired by so many movies from that. And I think, you know, more movies like this sort of that are dialogue driven and, you know, talent driven and, you know, rely on that. I think a lot more movies were sort of, more risks like this were taken in the past than they are now. So I think maybe all of those things sort of make it feel nostalgic, but it wasn't an intention, but I've heard that before too from other people. So it's a happy accident, I guess.
Yeah. It's funny that actually came up in an interview recently. I was doing an interview with another filmmaker, and we were kind of talking about that, about studios taking risks. And there did seem to be a time in the 90s, in the kind of wake of the kind of post-Linklater, post-Tarantino, that kind of era, there was money for projects that didn't necessarily fit a certain mold. And now that, for that kind of mid-range, it's kind of dried up. That's, you know, it's kind of fallen apart, that part of film. And it's just like,
yeah,
indie sure. stuff and really big, really fucking big stuff.
Yeah, well, there's like a sort of, the era that you're talking about has all of these sort of independent, quote unquote, films that are, but they're massive, with massive talent. And I think there's just it was a good time for studios. I think they were making enough money off their big blockbusters that they could make more of these sort of middle budget, you know, genre, you know, character and you know, sometimes director driven pieces. And yeah, I think now that middle world is so big now. It's, you know, it's either $100 million movies or movies being made for a couple hundred grand.
Yeah, it does seem to be this like massive disparity there of like, you're just, yeah, you're making indie movies or you're making like massive like Marvel blockbusters or whatever.
Yeah, it's the gaps. The gap just seems so insane right now. I mean, we're trying to, you know, Black Fawn and Breakthrough Entertainment, and now we have a partnership with a particular crowd, which is a Warner Turner company. And, you know, I think everybody's trying to do that thing where we're trying to make really high caliber, high end films for, you know, an okay budget, where everybody's making money, but it doesn't, you know, it doesn't get out of control. I'm just trying to find a nice happy medium where, you know, the studios can make their money back so we can continue to make movies, but also have enough money to make stuff that actually gets out there. Cause it seems like the smaller the budget, the harder it is for people to actually see it.
So to go back to the, like the shoot of the film and what you were doing on the film, I watched the film as part of Grimfest, digital festival at home with the heating on. But you know, it's a film that is viscerally cold. It's a cold quote. You can pretty much feel the snow coming out the screen. How did you create that effect, that kind of visceral coldness, the chill of the movie?
So it was, I mean, obviously we had shot, so the end of Canadian winter was all the exteriors and stuff, you know, as I mentioned before. But when we shot the bar stuff, that's all in the middle of the summer. So it's like outside of that set, all the crews wearing t-shirts, and it was a pretty warm studio. But, you know, we played with a ton of different effects for snow and, you know, the ice on the windows and stuff. And we did as much as we could in camera, but again, you know, you're in a dark basement bar, so you don't really see outside very much. So it was about every time we could cut to an exterior shot, whether it's the car that's approaching the Oak Room or the other stories, I wanted to make sure that those felt as cold as possible. And we spent a lot of time with sound design and there's wind and sort of the sound of wind over snow and stuff like that throughout the whole movie. So there's actually no point where there's not a sort of cold wind sound. And we played with using that sometimes, you know, in between dialogue, but also at, you know, at crucial moments when a character's getting angrier, the sound of sort of the cold nature kind of rises and stuff. And, you know, Steph Copeland, who wrote the score, you know, it was funny. I kept telling her and we couldn't put our fingers on what it actually meant, but we knew we wanted the score to be simple and sort of simple and natural, but also somehow encapsulate a cold Canadian winter. And it's not that we were like, oh, we need to use that instrument because that'll do that. But I think she incorporated some sort of wind sounds into her music as well and stuff. So there's a lot of factors that I was like, because, you know, as you said, it feels cold, which is good because I wanted it to feel as cold as possible and nobody to feel safe. So, you know, none of these bars have a fire and the radiators are sort of old and rusted and stuff like that. So I, you know, there was a conscious effort to try and make this thing feel as cold as possible.
Well, that effect was achieved. Well, it certainly was on my behalf, I can tell you. Overall, how smooth was the shoot? Was this, did it go pretty well, or was there any particular on-set disasters?
No, it was pretty smooth. There was no big incidents. There was a lot of sort of stressful points in the shoot, but we sort of made it out alive. Like for example, the Oak Room and the Spruce Tavern, the two bar sets. So those were built in studio, but it's only one set. So they built the Oak Room first, and then we shot that out in, I believe, 3 days. And then I think the art department had like two and a half days to sort of tear out the inside of it, you know, build a couple more walls and redress it to look like the Spruce Tavern. But it's the same set, same bar and everything, that's just repurposed and repainted. But there was moments where we went in to shoot the Spruce Tavern and we shot a certain way because the art department was still painting walls behind us. But so definitely... You know, we definitely travel along that thin line of you know, not being able to do certain things. But Justin Rue, who was the production designer, was incredible, and he put in some long hours to make sure that everything was ready. But yeah, no, there was no incidents on this one, which was refreshing.
To go back to the thing you were saying about the kind of Tarantino thing of like not wanting to make it seem like too wacky or flashy, I was wondering as well, how much time or effort did you spend thinking about the tone of the film? Obviously, there's a kind of sneaky kind of black comic element, but it's not a comic film, but there is a you know, a kind of smattering of funniness to it. But how did you go about kind of striking that balance of having that smattering but not having it overpower anything and it being essentially as serious?
I don't know, it's kind of funny because it's not that I guess from the get-go, it's like I knew that the way I was going to approach it and approach certain scenes that the whole film would be tense. And anytime you sort of dive into anything like that, it's good to make sure that you have moments in mind that you can sort of lighten the mood a bit, because, you know, if from the get-go, from the beginning of the movie to the end, if it's tense the whole time and you don't let the audience relax or breathe for a minute, sometimes you can overdo it or lose the audience. But if you're able to kind of take them on that roller coaster of the ups and downs, that I found that tends to work better. But as when it comes to sort of the humor in it, I actually think that it's just something that I do without thinking about it. I mean, after this movie, I directed a horror comedy, and that felt like that felt the most proper setting as a director that I've been in yet. So I think that some of the movies I've made before, when they get humorous, sometimes it's sort of done unintentionally. So I think that there's just a natural want sometime for me to get some humor in spots in between the tenseness of the films. And so I think, you know, that just kind of comes innately.
And I think there's some things with the performances and the dialogue as well. Like, you know, it's like we've talked about before, it's dialogue driven, character driven. There's a lot of dialogue, and you know, some of it's quite funny. And I like the Peter Outerbridge's line about, you know, like, you can't buy a fucking fridge with a story. Like, I was particularly entertained by that line. Did you have any particular favorite quotes from the movie?
I don't know if I had any favorite quotes, but in general, I feel like Peter Outerbridge, obviously, who plays Paul, he got a lot of the really good one-liners. And just his sort of small town grumpiness, I find. I mean, I'm from a small town. I know bartenders just like him, and there's just something about his performance that's so natural, and so he's being funny but without trying. And so I don't know if there's a certain line, but his performance in general, I thought was bang on between sort of the humorous bartender who can tell a story and a guy who could, you know, break your teeth out with one punch.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Which is very, very small town. I literally know these guys.
I hadn't even thought of that, you know, I come from a small town in the east coast of Scotland, and yeah, there is a kind of small town grumpiness to that character that I find identifiable in characters I knew from growing up. So like, yeah, maybe that's why I find it funny.
And it's that grumpiness and that sort of, they're almost a satire on themselves. They are a bartender, and they usually, you know, either own the bar at that point or have been there for forever. And they're almost character, like some of the people I know from the small town I'm from are characters on themselves. I mean,
yeah.
If they didn't get nervous, if you put a camera in their face, I did consider at one point of casting some real people in this. I mean, it was a short moment, because sometimes that can go really bad. But yeah.
I feel like we have something in common. I feel like small town Canada is very similar to small town Scotland, you know, in terms of like.
And I was just, it's so funny. I just having this conversation with somebody else, and I haven't been to Scotland, but my ancestors, I guess, are Irish. Mm-hmm. And there's something about that sort of small town Scotland, small town Ireland, and small town Canada that I feel like there's a similarity in the bars and tone that I feel like they'd all relate. I think you'd feel at home at a small Canadian bar.
Yeah, I just kind of, I can have an immediate, you know, just growing up in a small Scottish town, I just have like an immediate sense of it, of just like that kind of, it's just that bar that you walk into, and if you're an out-of-towner, everybody looks up from their pint, slightly confused and a bit annoyed. And
Yeah. It's almost as if you stepped into their living room by accident.
Yes.
And they want to tell you to go, but they're not gonna. And especially in Canada, you know, they'll be nice enough, but you know, have your couple pints and tip well and leave.
Yeah.
Some of the places I've been.
Absolutely. It's very much the same in small town Scotland. I would call it kind of terse politeness. Kind of politeness through gritted teeth.
Exactly. And unsure, you know, unsure of like, was that a, is he joking? Should I leave? Or is he kind of just warning me? Or yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Maybe that's why.
But God love him.
Yeah.
It just makes me want to go have a pint right now.
Kind of talking about the characters, did you talk much to the actors about the characters in terms of like, yeah, I mean, yeah, for I suppose, you know, to both of us growing up in these kind of small towns, kind of relatable, but you know, a lot of these guys are relatively shitty guys, and obviously you've got to still make them kind of relatable in a way and compelling in a way. And did you talk much about that with the actors, that element of it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was I mean, obviously that the script, it didn't do this so on its own, but it was important for me, especially now. I mean, it's all the parts are obviously played by men, and you know, in sort of this day and age, to have such a masculine film was, you know, I wanted to make sure that everybody was aware that this is not glorifying the the masculinity in men and fathers and sons. It's preying on the weaknesses and the insecurities and sort of those defects that get passed down sometimes between fathers and sons and you know, sort of these vicious cycles that some families get caught in. And so it was really important that everybody kind of understood what we were trying to say. And obviously not every father and son has the same story, and this isn't everybody, but there is, you know, there is people who get stuck in these vicious cycles, and there's a, you know, like father, like son, and they can't break out of it, whether it's, you know, alcoholism to abuse to, you know, racism, which is still, you know, a point of contention in some of these small towns, and especially where I'm from. I mean, I left pretty early, not because of that, but it always was sort of that thing that made me feel uncomfortable. And so I kind of moved to Toronto, Ontario, as soon as I could, where, you know, as multicultural as you can get for Canada. So there was all of this sort of tension and comment I wanted to sort of make on, you know, not how I grew up. I have should preface this with, I have a very good relationship with my father, but just some of the friends and some stuff that I've seen growing up, I wanted to make sure that I injected that in, and all the actors knew that there's a, you know, we're saying something very important and there's a message we want to get across. And I didn't want anybody to feel like we were glorifying any of these characters, because, you know, as you said, there's not really a character in this film who is a nice guy. Everybody's got deep rooted faults. And, you know, I mean, there's some stuff with Steve that you could, you know, somebody could connect to and feel sorry for him. But there's also some hints that he might be worse than the rest. Of course, I can't tell you what
obviously the truth obviously is. that would spoil the film. I mean, like I did get a sense of that commentary there, of that, you know, the kind of toxicity of, you know, that kind of that certain type of maleness that has an inability to emote, a kind of emotional constipation, you know, that, you know, and how kind of toxic that is, and how, you know, toxic it is to kind of passing it on generation to generation. You said that it's quite unusual in this day and age, in terms of like it being an all-male cast and it being this kind of brawny, masculine, muscular type writing. Were you at all like worried about that? I mean, like, you know, I myself am a 35-year-old white male, so feel like I'm pretty much in the target demographic for this movie. But were you worried at all about excluding other people, or other people finding it just not working for them in that way, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, from day one, it was obviously a concern in the back of my mind, but, you know, and you know, there was thoughts of changing some characters and switching up, sort of, rather than it being a father-son, you know, there was some ideas of mother-daughters and mothers and sons, and really kind of playing with that. I just, there was a real connection I had the very first time I read it to my past. And, you know, obviously being a, you know, coming from a small town and connecting with some of these people that I've met or I know, it just, at a certain point, I just felt like there was an instant spark and connection I had with the original material. And it just, I just sort of made the decision early on that it's like, let's just make it what it is now and not try to change it for somebody else. Unless, of course, we got a different director, then of course somebody could have changed it. I mean, if it had a female voice, I, you know, it would be so interesting to see what somebody would do with it, as far as changing characters early on or approaches to it. But since I was going to do it, it just kind of felt right to keep it the way it was, because I had already made so many connections right off the bat that it kind of felt, it felt odd to just sort of switch it around for somebody else's sake when I was the one that had to tell the story. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's sense. Why we kept it the way it was. But yeah, I mean, I always had a concern that somebody would say in this day and age, you know, making an all male cast would be a negative thing. But I just kept in the back of my mind that we're not glorifying it. You know, it's a comment, and I think I think mm-hmm. we're saying something that's important, and I hope that's what people take from it, is the message we're trying to send, and not, you know,
Yeah,
not the social message that we, that we said by accident or whatever.
It certainly sounds from what you were talking about and what you told the actors and stuff that you felt personally invested in, and personally that it was quite important to make comment on these issues of masculinity and the dark side of masculinity, this particular form of masculinity that often breeds, particularly in small towns.
Yeah, and like another thing that sort of solidified it kind of for me is that we shot, moving up to shooting of the movie, my wife was pregnant, and we shot the exteriors, and in between shooting the exteriors and our first day shooting in studio for the rest of the movie, my son was born. So there was this sort of big change in me, and it just sort of, when I knew I was going to make this movie, a year ago or 2 years ago now, I guess, a little bit more than that. I knew I was going to have a kid at some point. So, you have all these mental, like, what's it going to be like, and how am I going to change? And you sort of, I had all these sort of ideas, and then I met with all the actors, and then my son was born, and was like, oh, okay. And there was a lot of like, I don't want to, anything that's a fault in me, I'm terrified to pass down to my son. And at that point in time, I knew it was like, okay, well, I got to keep this script the way it is, because I know what to tell the actor of things that I'm feeling. And a lot of these actors are now connecting with me, telling me about their kids that they have. And a lot of the conversations that we were having on set in between shooting was, about their kids, something good that's happened, something bad that's happened. So there was this really deep connection from the get-go. So, I mean, all of those factors sort of made me trust the material. And I hoped that it would come across, in a certain way that nobody would sort of attack us for making an all-male cast film this day and age. But that hasn't happened yet. So I hope that, I hope that people got the message.
Well, kind of rolling forward from the shoot of the movie onto the release of the film, how relieved, how happy were you that the film ended up, getting festival run, given that, COVID has obviously derailed so much, and, then these digital festivals popped up. How happy were you with that, first of all with Fantasia, and now you've been at several festivals?
Yeah, so I mean, we finished the film, and then felt like 4 days after, I think I actually had 4 days off from the last day of post on the Oak Room, I went right into directing another movie. So it's not that we sat on the Oak Room, but we sort of, we were kind of doing two things at once. And by the time we finished shooting the film that we did after the Oak Room called Vicious Fun, we were starting to submit the Oak Room to festivals. And then of course, Christmas and New Year's and all that hit. So then, 2020 came around and we started submitting to festivals, and then obviously COVID hit, and it was like, at first it was like, oh shit, is this ever going to see festivals? Are we sitting on this stuff for a year? And then it kind of felt like there was a long time, maybe a month or so or 2 months, where the industry and especially festivals in general were pretty silent. And then it was sort of one of those things where, everybody's in the same boat, but I was like, oh no, did we just make this movie? And now, now it's going to get buried amongst, the times that we're in, and like, is anybody actually going to see this? And then I want to say the first festival we got into was Fantasia, and we got an email from Mitch Davis saying that he'd watched it and loved it. And then that sort of getting into that festival sort of, I think helps get notice of other festivals. And then from there, it's been great. I couldn't even tell you how many festivals we've done right now, but somewhere around 12 or 13, and each festival has been fantastic. The reviews have been great. The interviews have been awesome. And so, yeah. So, I mean, if I could go back to the panicked me thinking nobody was going to see this to now, it's been a journey for sure.
And as I mentioned, I saw the festival here in the UK at the Grimfest Digital Festival, which you picked up the Audience Award for. How happy were you about what was your reaction to that?
It was amazing. I mean, me personally, I'm not sort of, I don't know, I like doing interviews now, but I'm a pretty antisocial guy. I'm pretty shy in person. So all of the sort of awards for, directing or anything like that, I never really think about those. But I feel like for me, the Audience Award is sort of the best, because I mean, that's where we're making films four is the audience. So if the audience is saying that's the best one, then I feel like that's the best award you can get, because the director one seems sort of, you know, it's a good personal thing and an individual thing and obviously an ego booster. But an audience award is sort of saying everybody did something special in this one. And, you know, and since the whole reason we make movies is the audience, then to have them decide it's the best is, you know, that's about as good as you can get.
You've mentioned a couple of times your other film, Away from the Oak Room, Vicious Fun, which recently premiered at Stitches, I believe. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So it's about a horror movie reviewer, a horror movie critic who manages to stumble upon a support group for serial killers. And he's sort of got to match wits with these guys in order to sort of survive the night. But it's a straight up horror comedy. And it was made literally just for fun. Like, we wanted people to just be able to sit back and turn their brains off and just go on this fun, ridiculous journey. And it's pretty wacky and out there, but it was hysterical to make. And I'm pretty excited for people to see that one too. And it's the complete polar opposite of The Oak Room.
Yeah, it certainly looks like a lot of fun from the trailer. And you're working again with Ari Millen, as I see in that movie.
Yeah.
He looks like he's having a lot of fun in the role he's playing from the trailer.
Yeah, totally. It's funny. Me and Ari actually grew up in the same crib way back. Like, I think he's like one of my, or my oldest friend. Yeah.
And when can we expect to see that in the UK?
I think, because of COVID, it pushed back our, when we could finish the movie. So we sort of got it, like, we finished it just before we submitted to Sitges. So we sort of came in at the end of the sort of that genre festival run. But I'm hoping that early next year it gets out there. I think Vicious Fun, again, I get them mixed up because I'm like, sometimes I'm getting on interviews and I think it's for Vicious Fun, but it's actually Oak Room and vice versa. It's a really weird time. I've never had two films at once, but I think Vicious Fun is playing Monster Fest next.
Okay, so the Oak Room is still going on at its festival run at the moment.
I feel like I should know this. I should have been better prepared. But I think it's playing a couple more festivals between now and sort of December. But then I think around then it's gonna start to slow down. Because I think this weekend is it? Oh yeah, this weekend Vicious Fun is playing Monster Fest, and the Oak Room is playing South African Horror Fest.
Cool. Okay. So I mean, obviously you must be very busy between those two films still going on their festival runs. But are you working on anything else at the moment? Is there any films in the pipeline that you're coming out with?
Yeah. So I'm writing a film right now that as I said, my son was born during the filming of The Oak Room, and then I went right into Vicious Fun. So I'm gonna probably take a little break from directing, but I'm writing some stuff right now with Chad Archibald, who's the co-owner of Black Fun Films, and he's got a film that he's going to direct probably mid to later next year. So I'm going to be producing that, and then I've got a film that I'm set to direct that's just going into, I think, a third or fourth draft, but I can't talk about the title yet, but early next year there should be some stuff. But Black Fawn is staying extremely busy, like we always are.
So there are quite a few films on the slate in terms of your production company, Black Fawn Distribution.
Yes.
Okay, cool. Well, it's been great to have you on the show, Cody. It's been great talking to you about The Oak Room. Maybe when the Vicious Fun comes out in the UK, maybe we can have you back on the show again, or that, you know, film that you can't yet talk about sometime in the future. But yeah, it's been great talking to you, and we'd like to have you on the show again.
Great, yeah, thank you. It was awesome.
That was my guest Cody there who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show, as well as thanking you, listener, for tuning in to this latest episode of New Horror Express. And remember, if you like what you heard, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Stitcher. Unfortunately, that is all for this time, but be sure to tune in next time when we will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya!